Today at Reader's Corner, Greg Bornheisel, author of Codename Puritan, Norman Holmes Pearson at the Nexus of Poetry, Espionage, and American Power. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Imagine the life of a professor who had a major impact on the study of American culture, but who also volunteered for wartime counter-espionage work, neutralizing the Nazi spy network. In his latest book, Codename Puritan, Norman Holmes Pearson at the Nexus of Poetry, Espionage, and American Power, Greg Bornheisel maps the life of this most fascinating professor and spy in his powerful role in the cultural and political realms of Cold War America. Greg Bornheisel is professor of English at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He is the author of Cold War Modernists, Art, Literature, and Cultural Diplomacy, and he's the author of James Laughlin, New Directions and the Remaking of Ezra Pound. Greg Bornheisel, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's a pleasure to be on.
Oh, it's really nice to have you. After reading your book, I was just really anxious to get your own personal take on how this all comes down. What is obviously so unusual about your book as a World War II account of the war is that most of those who served did not come from the academic world. Here's a guy who has his roots at Yale. He emerges as an architect and practitioner of wartime espionage during and after the war. So maybe we could just kick off our conversation with your shorthand version of just who Norm Pearson was, without going into too much detail or any detail about his wartime effort, because I'll get to that with some of my other questions.
Okay, great. Yeah. So Norman Pearson, he grew up in a small Massachusetts town called Gardner, where his family were very prominent citizens. They ran the major department store there. And Gardner at the time was an industrial town. It was called Chair City, still is called Chair City, because there was a lot of furniture factories there. And Pearson's family were old New Englanders, old New England WASPs, and they had Puritan heritage. And in fact, his mother was related to William Brewster, who was the pastor on the Mayflower. So he had this kind of very old New England, old Yankee upbringing. When he was a young man, he was actually not a young man, he was about 7 years old. He had an accident. He fell off a barn roof that resulted in a pretty terrible injury. He had a compound fracture in his leg that came poking through. It shattered his pelvis as well. So when they set the bone, they set it poorly. He ended up having a right leg that was 2 inches shorter than his left, which caused him, of course, to kind of look strange and walk strange, and also to develop a hunchback. But the more scary thing that came out of that was tuberculosis bacteria colonized the wound, and he didn't heal. The infection didn't heal from the time he was 7 until he was almost 35 years old. So he was walking around sort of like hunched over, limping, hunchbacked, and then with an open wound for most of his life. He ended up going to Yale. He studied English, American literature at Yale. And when he was at Yale, you know, he'd been planning to study business, but he decided he wanted to go into English literature. He gets his degree and he starts working with some professors who are developing an academic field that eventually becomes called American Studies, which kind of combines the study of literature, the study of history, the study of sociology in an effort to understand what the American character and American civilization were really about. And then he spends a couple of years at Oxford. He gets a scholarship to go to Oxford, and there at Oxford, even though he wants to study American literature, he's forced to study the most boring subject at all to him, which is like Anglo-Saxon language and literature. But oddly enough, his tutor was a guy named C.S. Lewis, the man who would eventually write the Narnia books, but right at the time was still just a tweedy academic. And so that brings him, he comes back to Yale and he gets his doctorate, and then that brings him up to his service in the war.
And as far as Yale is concerned, tell us about the Yale at that time, how it saw its educational mission. And as I remember it, it was a stronghold of isolationist opinion, maybe the birthplace of America First.
Yeah, you're exactly right about that. When Pearson came to Yale in the 20s, Yale was, it's hard for us to imagine this now, but it was a major athletic power. It was winning national championship in football, in rowing, in boxing, in the sports that were most popular in the country at the time. But it was actually kind of struggling financially. It was trying to figure out how it was going to stay afloat. It was primarily populated by the children of the East Coast establishment. So it wasn't, you know, we often think of Yale today as being a place where the most high-powered students from all over the country are going. You know, if you got to have a perfect SAT and you got to have a perfect grade point average and all these activities to get in Yale. And that was not the case back then. Mm-hmm. Yale was a place where if you came from the right kind of family, you could get in. And it wasn't particularly hard because Yale didn't primarily see itself as an academic institution. It was a place where we were creating the future leaders of America, who were all men. Yale was all male. And they were all coming from basically the same sector of society, which was this upper middle class East Coast establishment. So it was very, very insular and a very small world at the time. One of the interesting things that happens when Pearson gets there is Yale gets a whole bunch of money from a couple of benefactors and starts rebuilding the physical campus. And so for any of your listeners who've been to New Haven and seen Yale, this is beautiful Gothic quadrangle, sort of looks like Oxford. Didn't look anything like that at the time when Pearson got there.
So Norm Pearson had a draft classification that did not require him to serve in the war. You might share with us why that was, but how does he wind up in the day at the Office of Strategic Services, which not many Americans really appreciate these days, but it's the precursor to the CIA, and Wild Bill Donovan was building something big here.
That's absolutely right. So as you had mentioned earlier, the other thing that Yale was in the late 1930s was the birthplace of the America First movement, and there was a strong strain of isolationism on campus. Charles Lindbergh came and actually founded the American First Party, was founded there, or the American First Movement was founded there. But a man named Kingman Brewster, who would later go on to become the president of Yale, was a student who was in charge of this movement. Pearson, though, he had been in England, as I mentioned earlier, and he was strongly pro-involvement. He really thought the United States should have gotten into the war earlier. He thought the United States should have gotten into the war as soon as the Brits got into the war, or to support them, because he saw this as a real threat to basically the American way of life. Mm-hmm. So he wants to get into the fight once the fight starts. Yale kind of empties out because most of the students and a number of the professors get drafted or join the war effort. But he, because of his disability, he's classified that he can't do any active service. So for a couple of years, he languishes around the campus and is given various odd jobs to do. But some of these Yalies who have joined both the American Secret Services and the British Secret Services say, this is a real smart guy. He wants to get into the fray. Let's find something for him to do. They give him a couple assignments in New Haven, trying to figure out whether some of these America Firsters were actually working for the Nazis. But in 1942, the OSS calls him and says, we'd like you to come to Washington and we'd like you to come join our institution. We're recruiting a lot of Yale professors and other Ivy League professors because of your skills with textual analysis and ferreting out information. They bring him to Washington and he does a few weeks of work in what's called the research and analysis branch, which is doing exactly that kind of thing, looking at texts and analyzing them. But then his commanding officer says, this guy might be the kind of person who could actually build a counterintelligence agency, and we really need that. So I think we're going to have him run something that's going to handle the intelligence that the British are getting from the decrypts of the Enigma code machine. So that's how he gets involved in that.
So is that the X2 mission?
That's correct. So the British, as anybody who has seen the movie The Imitation Game will remember, the British had broken the codes that were generated by a German machine called the Enigma code machine. The British had broken it, but they didn't want the Germans to know they'd broken it because they wanted them to keep using that machine. So the British had this intelligence. They won't give it to the Americans because they are afraid that the Americans are so clumsy, we're going to tip the Germans off to the fact that the codes have been broken.
Right.
So there's a lot of negotiation goes on between the British Secret Services, MI6, and what was called the Committee of 20. And then the Americans, primarily represented by General Wild Bill Donovan. The settlement they come to is that the Americans can have this information if they start a dedicated agency within the OSS, the only people that are going to handle this. This is the only eyes that will see this information. And they're the only ones who can make decisions about whether that information gets passed on to other branches of the OSS or eventually the US military. That institution is called X2. And that is what Pearson ends up heading in London.
You mentioned the 20 committee. We've interviewed Ben McIntyre on this show. Not for the book that comes to mind as I read your book, because what comes to mind as I read your book, because you talk about it, is Operation Mincemeat. And as I understand it, Norm Pearson had something to do with that fake job that the Americans and Brits pulled off. You might tell our listeners about that.
He did. He did. So your listeners may remember that Operation Mincemeat was an effort to deceive the Germans about where the invasion of Europe was going to come from. The Germans knew that the Americans and the British were going to embark on some sort of invasion of Europe, but they didn't know where it was going to happen at first. So Operation Mincemeat was this pretty innovative way of providing some disinformation to the Germans. They found a corpse, and I forget if it was somebody from a prison somewhere, but they found a corpse, dressed it up in a British Army uniform, and stuffed his pockets full of information that the actual D-Day invasion, that this invasion of Europe was going to come somewhere in, I think it was Brittany rather than in Normandy. They were trying to fool the Germans into massing their troops in a spot where the invasion was actually not going to come. Pearson wasn't directly involved in organizing Operation Mincemeat, but he was the supervisor for the American agents who were working on that. When he was in X2, what his real job was initially was to help the British ferret out all of the German spies who were operating in Allied territory. And at the time when Pearson got over there in 1943, Allied territory literally consisted of Great Britain. That was it. The rest of Europe was either neutral or under Nazi control. After the D-Day invasion, Pearson's job was to recruit and train agents who would follow the American army as the American army swept across France and into Belgium and Holland and eventually into Germany, and find all the German spies and the saboteurs and the stay-behinds that were doing German work behind what were now the lines in Allied territory. So that was his primary job. He had a number of other jobs because he was the head of X2. Things like, your listeners may have seen the movie Monuments Men, which is about the American Army units that were finding the artworks and rare books and rare manuscripts that the Germans had stolen from the populations that they had invaded and stashed away. Pearson wasn't in charge of that unit because that was an army unit, but he was in charge of the OSS unit that was doing all the legal paperwork that enabled the Allies and the rightful owners to get those artworks back. And so we've just seen, just recently, there was a settlement getting some Nazi stolen art back for, I think it was a Dutch family that it had been stolen from. And some of the paperwork and legal preparations that Pearson had been in charge of were used in that. So even as late as 2024, the stuff he was doing is still having an effect in the real world.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Greg Bornheisel. He's the author of Codename Puritan, Norman Holmes Pearson at the Nexus of Poetry, Espionage, and American Power. Earlier in his career, Norman Pearson traveled to Germany, and he witnessed Hitler stirring a German crowd at the Circus Krone rally. You reprinted the letter he sent reporting on what he saw, and I'll let our listeners draw their own conclusions, but here's a quote. This is from Pearson at the time. Everywhere was this red. It seemed to inflame, to make the hall seem revolutionary, vital. And then another quote about Hitler. He used scorn, wit against the government. The people screamed with delight. Boy, that doesn't sound just like it happened in the 30s. It sounds like it happened just not too long ago, Greg.
Well, that's what I was thinking when I saw the footage of that Madison Square Garden rally.
Yeah, exactly. And then you say, and this is really interesting, by the time you get to the latter part of your book, you're contrasting how Pearson first thought about the role that Hitler was playing in Europe. And then later on, and I think this is your quote, like many other Americans in those Depression years, he was wondering whether some kind of strongman rule was not, in fact, the answer for the times. But he doesn't stick with that view forever.
No, he doesn't. And again, that's a sort of chilling vibrations coming off of that, given what's happened recently in this country. But so Pearson, after, as I mentioned earlier, after he finished up his undergraduate degree at Yale, he went over to England for a couple of years to pursue a second bachelor's at Oxford. But because you don't have to go to school very much at Oxford, I think that there's only 24 weeks of school. So in the time between semesters, he would go to Germany and study German. The first time he went was in the summer of 1932, which was before Hitler had been named chancellor. And it was when he was actually, when the Nazi Party was actually running in those elections. And so Pearson does go and listen to a Hitler rally in Munich at the Circus mm-hmm. Krone. And he is wondering why this is so compelling and what about the energies that this man and his followers are stirring up resonate with so many people. And he doesn't ever say I became sympathetic to the Nazis or anything, but he understands why it would be powerful, why it would be motivating. He also sees kind of Nazi imagery and Nazi feelings and Nazi iconography taking over Germany in the following couple of years as he continues to return over the course of 1933 and 1934 and watching, you know, the full Nazi takeover of the country. And like, as I said, and as you mentioned, like many people at this time in the Depression, they were wondering, is strongman rule actually what we need in mm-hmm. order to get us out of the Depression? Mm-hmm. He goes and he listens to Sir Oswald Mosley, who was the head of the British Fascist Party, the British Union of Fascists. When he comes to Oxford to do Oxford debates, he comes and listens to the Communist Party. So he's wondering, what's the right solution? He always is a New England Republican. He always is voting Republican. He only voted for Democrats a couple times in his life. But by the time that war comes around, he has spent so much time studying the American character and deciding that the characteristics of fascism, which is a kind of drive for uniformity, which is emotion over rationality, which is kind of... And Hannah Arendt talked about it as fascism says, like, anything is possible. There are no rules anymore. And Pearson, because he feels his Puritan roots, because he feels this essential Americanness, is completely opposed to those sort of ideas. Americans are pragmatic. Americans are realistic. Americans are rational and thoughtful. And so this kind of fascism, populism, authoritarianism, in Pearson's view, is incompatible with the American character. And so the night he's sitting in New York City and he's listening to the radio broadcast on September 1st, 1939, as Hitler's troops are coming into Poland. And he reflects on the time when he was watching Hitler and listening to him talk. And he was saying, I felt at that time the kind of forbidden thrill of mm-hmm. what it would be like to be part of this movement. And now I understand this is not what we are and this is not who we should be.
You point out in your book that Norman Pearson never really saw action the way we usually read about that in World War II. But he was in London when London was being bombed during the Blitz, I guess. And that wasn't exactly the safest place to be. And it didn't seem to concern him that much. He was there to do a job, would you say?
Absolutely. He wasn't there for the, when we think of the Blitz, we usually think of the Blitz as 1940. So that would be a period in 1940 where they were really carpet bombing London, Sheffield, places like that. So Pearson comes a little bit after that. He comes in a time that I guess for me would be even scarier. After the Germans have developed the V1 and the V2 rockets, and they were also called buzz bombs because they made this sort of like buzzing, whining noise just before they would hit. Mm-hmm. And so he was there when they started the V2 barrages, 1944, and talks about that and talks about he had a housekeeper, and the housekeeper would go out and see the destruction around him and be looking for the pork chops. And we often think of the British as having this this stiff upper lip sense about like destruction about them. Keep calling him carry on. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so he adopts that. He adopts that. But some of his closest friends, the poet H.D. and her partner Breyer, are living in Lowndes Square in London, and their house is cleaved in half by a buzz bomb, and they end up having to leave and move to Cornwall. So it was, being in London was terrifying, even if you didn't see action. Mm-hmm. But Pearson never saw combat action. He did have some stories, and one of the stories I tell in the book is that soon after he's brought over to England, OSS sends him to Madrid to open an OSS office for Iberia, because some of your listeners will probably know Spain was a great marketplace of secrets because it was neutral. And so a lot of the spies were operating there. OSS sends Pearson over to open up an office there. And when he checks into his hotel, the Excelsior Hotel in Madrid, he walks up to his room and he puts the key in the door and he looks across the hallway and there's an SS man with a machine gun standing outside the door opposite. And he wonders who this is. And so he goes down and asks the hotelier, and he says, oh, that's Walter Schellenberg, who's the head of the German counterintelligence, the SD. And the hotelier apparently put them in opposite rooms as a practical joke.
Mm-hmm.
But later, as the war ends, Pearson does really want to get into it. So he manages to parachute, even with his fused leg and all of his disabilities, he parachutes into both Copenhagen and Oslo in the last week of the war as those countries are liberated. And then he is out in the party in London in Trafalgar Square on VE Day, and somehow, even with his disability, managed to crawl up on top of one of those lions in Trafalgar Square.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's what really got me after learning about the extent of this childhood injury that he lived with for the rest of his life, and seeing the photo you put in the book of this guy trying to sit on a chair. He couldn't sit on a chair the way we sit on a chair. Half of him had to hang off the chair. And now I'm thinking of him jumping out of a plane. I mean, that takes a significant amount of courage right there. Those landings aren't always soft, shall we say.
No, they wouldn't be.
Today I'm speaking with Greg Barnheisel, author of Codename Puritan. The book is a fascinating biography of Norman Holmes Pearson, an unassuming literary scholar and part-time spy who transformed post-war American culture. So his organizational skills really served both the U.S. and Britain so well. Give us an idea of what he created in the process. I mean, the paperwork, the documents, the cables. It was an unbelievable amount of data that by the time the war was over, we had on the Germans.
No, it really was. And it was an entirely new way of handling information. I think we're all very familiar with the concept of big data, with the concept of just of how social media companies operate. They just like record every data point possible, and they know eventually you can run computer models on them and figure out things from them. But that wasn't the way it worked back in that time. The British had started the kind of big data system in which they kept notebook card files. And if those of your listeners who remember old card catalogs from libraries, they had card catalogs and they just kept note card files on. It ended up being about 800,000 people living in Great Britain who they thought were suspicious or potentially German agents or people who they needed to keep an eye on. And then they would just, every time they got another data point on that, they would just add it to a note card. And the United States didn't do that. But Pearson, he sees the British are doing this and he says, we have to start doing this too. And we just have to start, because he's a humanities professor. He's an academic, he's an intellectual. He knows that gather as much information as possible, let smart people look over it. They're going to find patterns. They're going to find things that are significant. So he institutes this kind of big data collection. And those of us who may remember the George W. Bush years and the hoovering up of all people's cell phone calls and all sorts of signals intelligence. I mean, it led to that. And many of us feel pretty ambivalent about that, if not really negative about it. But Pearson was one of the first people to institute that kind of approach to intelligence collection in the U.S. Army. The other really significant contribution that he made, really long-lasting contribution that he made, was the curriculum that we use to train counterintelligence officers. And counterintelligence just means trying to find the people who are spying on you, trying to find the people who are embedded in your country who are looking to ferret out secrets. And so he learned, because the British had been doing that for a long time, the Americans had never had a counterintelligence agency. So he learned from his counterparts in British intelligence how to do this. He developed a curriculum. And when the CIA was founded in 1947, he was asked to be the director of counterintelligence. He turned it down to stay at Yale. But the curriculum he had developed was implemented at CIA verbatim and was the counterintelligence curriculum there for a number of years, even after the war had ended and he had disappeared back into New Haven.
So tell us what recognition he received for his war efforts by the time it's all over, both from the Army and President Truman.
He received the Medal of Freedom from President Truman. He was named a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor in France. He was named to the Order of St. Olaf in Norway. But he couldn't tell anybody any of these things because all of the work that he did was completely secret. He couldn't tell anybody any of the things that he had done. And it wasn't until a book came out by John Masterman in 1971, I believe, published ironically by Yale University Press, called The Double Cross System. And it detailed what Pearson and the Committee of 20 in Britain were doing. And one of their innovations that the Committee of 20 had come up with was, when we find these spies operating in Allied territory, we don't just arrest them or kill them, we flip them. We flip them so they start giving the Germans disinformation and they start telling us what's going on with the Germans. So in this book, which comes out in 1971, you know, we're a quarter century after the war is over, only then did Pearson's activities really come to light. And he wrote the introduction for that book. And he was very, he had already developed a reputation at Yale as being a guy who had been in the spy services. And in fact, many people thought he was continuing to be in the spy services. And he loved having that reputation and he loved being sort of sly about that. Right. When the book came out, though, he was really gratified that people could actually see what he had done.
So after the war, what were Norm Pearson's career options? He didn't have to go into the academic world. I think he had some offers elsewhere.
Yes, as I just mentioned, he was offered the position of chief of counterintelligence at CIA, which ironically eventually went to both his Yale student and then the man he had trained in OSS London, James Jesus Angleton, a name that many of your readers, many of your listeners will know. So he turned that job down. He was also offered a job at the Department of State that he turned down, but he became a literature professor. And so for about 15 years, he really dedicated himself to that and just lived the kind of mundane life of a professor of literature mm-hmm. at Yale.
But describe for us what kind of teacher he was. And I mean that in two ways. First of all, the fact that he was a teacher there in the classroom and what his students and his colleagues thought of him, but also his teaching, you might say, as a boss when he was doing his counterintelligence work. You seem to point out that he did really some amazing things with people who he trained.
He did. He took advantage of the fact that his body looked so strange to people. And so he was a very theatrical person. He was a very physical teacher. And he had learned that you've got to, and I can confirm this, when you're teaching a bunch of freshman writing classes, you got to keep their attention. And so he would use his kind of misshapen body and his cigarette and his tone of voice to maintain their attention. And he would be self-deprecating. So Scott Donaldson, who was his student back in the 50s and was a biographer, who wrote biographies of F. Scott Fitzgerald and all that, told me that Pearson would walk in on the first day of class and he's saying, "When God made me, he made me defective." And then there would be this pregnant pause and everybody would be looking at him. And he's like, "I'm not going to be able to remember all your names." So the students would then laugh and laugh. But he really had, because he was a little bit of a misfit at Yale, he developed a following of a bunch of misfits at Yale. So he ended up with working with graduate students and directing dissertations from many people who ended up becoming unlikely, if important, people in academia. But I would say his most familiar and well-known dissertation directee was the famous writer and journalist Tom Wolfe. And Tom Wolfe, who was the author of The Right sure. Stuff and The Bonfire of the Vanities and all that,
right. Wow.
He had submitted a dissertation to Yale about the League of American Writers, which was a sort of leftist writers group in the 30s. And Yale had rejected the dissertation because it was too political. And they said, it's not objective and academic enough. And he was going to quit, but Pearson said, okay, I'll take over this. I'll handle it. We'll get you through. And so Pearson ended up directing his dissertation and the two of them remained lifelong friends. And Tom Wolfe gave the eulogy at Pearson's funeral.
Mm-hmm. I have time for one more question. We haven't talked about his personal life. In your acknowledgments, you lead off thanking his stepdaughter, Susan Addis, for the time she gave you. It sure seems like his two stepdaughters were very close to him, that he loved them dearly. And I suppose that's the reason why she was so willing to give of her time now that she, of course, is, I think she may be the surviving stepdaughter. Is that correct?
She is, yes. Yeah. So he married a divorcee. And at the time, this woman, Susan Bennett, had two daughters, ages 10 and 8. And soon after they married, he went off to war. So it took, as his daughter, Sue Addis, had told me, it took a little bit of time for them to warm up. Blended families can be tough. And they had their father was a problem. But by a couple years after he got back from war, his two daughters, Sue and Lizzie, became very, very devoted to him. He wanted to have children with his wife, Susan, but she unfortunately had a hysterectomy during the war. So they never were able to have their own children. But he was very much a father to Sue and Lizzie. And Lizzie is, unfortunately, Lizzie was murdered in the 1980s in a gas station robbery in Connecticut. And she had had a very hard and tragic life and developed schizophrenia and serious mental illness when she was a teenager. Came out of it when she was 40 and then was senselessly murdered, which is very sad. But Sue Addis, the older sister, is still going strong and lives near New Haven, age 94. And she's the former president of the American Public Health Association and the former state health commissioner of Connecticut. And she was very excited about this book. And it was such a pleasure to be able to complete it and show her. And she has really liked it, as well as his niece, Liz Rice, who also lives in Massachusetts, who was very helpful with the book as well.
Well, as I said, we've run out of time, Greg, but we haven't been able to get to the part where he really plays a key role in the field of American studies. You mentioned that early on. I just want to remind our listeners that there's so much more to this book than what we're able to cover now, but I can't thank you enough for writing it. It's just a great tale of a real American hero, I think you could say. The name of the book is Codename Puritan, Norman Holmes Pearson at the Nexus of Poetry, Espionage, and American Power. Greg Bornheisel, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
What happens in Washington? The NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.